Even though this is a Swedish podcast, I will do the whole episode in English to welcome listeners from other countries as well, so they also can listen to this talk between me and the author, entrepreneur, and inspirational speaker, Elizabeth Gilbert.
Your understanding of the reality of the terms of life is that nobody's promised tomorrow. Nobody. And this is the great equalizer, because it doesn't matter what you have, what you've been given, how successful you are. There's no promise of tomorrow.
One of the movies that inspired me the most is Eat, Pray, Love, based on the book of the same title. It's written by Elizabeth Gilbert, who penned it based on a journey she took to find happiness. Through the book Eat, Pray, Love, Time magazine named Elizabeth one of the 100 most influential people in the world. Since then, she has continued to inspire people with her books, though she is constantly curious about evolving. It hasn't been a straight path, but the challenges and setbacks she has faced have also been part of her drive to learn more about herself and life and a continuous forward motion. She often talks about her fears, but that her curiosity is slightly bigger, which helps her handle the fear. Now Elizabeth is on a European tour where she lectures on a creative life beyond fear. On April the 20th, she will come to Stockholm at Waterfront. And I can say I bought the ticket as quickly as I could, because Elizabeth, or Lizzie as she is often called, is one of those who inspired me the most through her writing and way of finding the right words for quite messy life situations. And with those quotes, I have found it easier to handle certain challenges. I am incredibly happy to have Elizabeth with me in my podcast. I'm curious about, well, pretty much everything. So London was the opening night for this European tour.
Yeah.
How come you actually decided to go to Europe?
Well, I got invited, and I like to say yes to wonderful invitations. There's a gentleman who runs a production company, and he produces a lot of speaking tours for people who are spiritual teachers mostly, like Eckhart Tolle and Marianne Williamson. And he approached me last year, and we did a wonderful tour in Canada. And it went so well that he said, let's do a European tour. So, of course, I said yes. And I'm so delighted to be coming. And I'm so delighted to be coming back to Stockholm. It's been a while since I've been there. But I'm very happy to be.
You actually do have, what do you say in English, ancestors?
Yeah, yes. My mother is an Olsen. And her father's parents came from Sweden, from the Södertälje area, to the United States about 100 years ago. And I've been to Sweden many times. My mother and I actually drove across Sweden as a college graduation present for me. We went and investigated our ancestry and our heritage. And that was back in 1991. And that was my first trip. But I've been back many times. And I love it. It always feels like home. And everybody looks like my cousins. So it literally feels like
so you
home.
Can actually tell yeah, that you're real.
Yeah, like I look at you and I'm like, yeah, oh, you look just like my cousin Lisa.
It's so much fun. I just have to tell you the story, because when I saw that you were actually coming to Sweden, I thought on Instagram, and I thought it was kind of a fake, because I couldn't believe it. The Eat, Pray, Love, and about the book, which I read from many years ago, but I've seen the movie several times. I just couldn't believe it, so I have to check if it was a fake or not before I bought the ticket. Because sometimes it's like, and I told my kids, they are 27 and 22 boys, and I said, you know, Elizabeth Gilbert, and said, like, who? Yeah, Eat, Pray, Love. You know the movie. And it's like, do we know the movie? I mean, you're talking about it all the time. Yeah, but she's coming. And then she said, you know, I'm going to have her in my podcast. And I said, that's bigger for you than Michelle Obama and Oprah.
Oh.
And I was like, yes, yes. So I'm super happy that you're
Kristen,
with me today.
I'm so touched. And I'm so touched that 27-year-old boys have heard of Eat, Pray, Love. You've done good work.
Yes. And I forced them to see it. And actually, it's so interesting with that movie, I think, because when I saw it the first time, I was, I thought it was like a nice movie, and then I read the book that came to me more. But then I went to Bali 2020 in January, and then I decided to see it again. And probably I was in another time in life, because I had to stop the movie to write down different sentences because they really got into me. And what I think that you do so well is that you, in an easy way, explain something that I can feel is so hard or difficult. Oh. So how do you work with that? How do the words come to you or the sentences that makes it easier than it? We make it kind of complicated sometimes.
Thank you for saying that. I'm touched to hear that. I have a philosophy as a writer, which is that the most important thing is to be coherent. The most important thing is to make sure that anybody who can read my book is never left behind, you know, like on any concept. And I feel like it's my job to do exactly what you said, to take some of the most difficult, painful, or emotional moments of life, or even complex spiritual or philosophical ideas, and to express it in such a way that there's nobody reading it who won't understand what I'm saying. It's a very different writing style. I love some writers who are very complex and very poetic and very lyrical and very intellectual, and I enjoy that. But for me, I feel like this is a means of communication. That's what we're doing here. Like, that's what a book is. And why in the world would you want to write something that somebody might not be able to understand? Why in the world would you want to write something that somebody might have to stop reading on that page because it was beyond them? And so I spend a lot of time reading every single sentence that I write to make sure, is there a simpler way that I can say this? Is everybody with me? You know, like, because I want to be with you. I want to be with you at the level of the heart. I want us to be together. I think connection to me is so much more important than originality or trying to impress anybody. You know, I'm not interested in trying to impress anybody. I'm interested in connection. And so I'm really touched that you pointed that out because it means everything to me. I want to make sure that nobody is left behind on the journey.
Yeah, and I think also that I write a few books or five.
Wow, that's modest. I've written a few books. Okay, five.
No, but I read that you said, I'm not good at grammar. I'm not, you know, that kind of writer. I'm just telling a story. And that makes me smile because I always felt, you know, a little bit like I'm not perfect grammar. I just want to communicate. And once someone mentioned my book and they said it's very easy to read, and I thought that was a really nice compliment to get. I really loved when that they said it was easy to read, because then I thought that, you know, then a lot of people can read it instead of being that a little bit more complicated. So I think it's really nice to, why make it so hard when it can be
exactly,
easy?
Exactly. I mean, the book is a gift for you in a weird way. It's not about me. You know, I already, like with Eat, Pray, Love, I already had the experience. I already had the richness of the journey. I already got to go to Italy and eat for 4 months. I already got to go to India and experience life in an ashram. I already got to go to Bali. Like, I've gotten what I needed, right? So now the whole point of the thing is now I want you to have that experience through me. So it's not really, it's about you. It should be about the reader, not about the writer. That's what I think.
But I also think that you said something about that you kind of write and you see one person in front of you when you write.
Yes, this is a trick. Something that I often ask people when they're working on a book, especially if it's a first-time book, and I ask them, who is your book for? Who are you writing this book for? Who are you writing this book to? And it's a really important question because, generally speaking, people will answer that question with a demographic. They'll say, I'm writing this book for women who are in their 50s, who are starting their lives over after a divorce. Or I'm writing this book for survivors of cancer. Or I'm writing this book for anybody who has ever lost a child. Or I'm writing this book for anybody who has ever suffered with addiction. But that's not really a person. That's like a vague general group of people. And my experience is that if you're writing to a group of people, your book is going to sound sort of like a speech, sort of like a business presentation. And not like something that a human being is speaking to another human being. So the guidance that I always give people is choose one person in your life and write the book to them, directly to one person. And each one of my books, and I've written a number of them now, each one of them has been written to one person. And each book was written to a different person, because it's really important to choose who that person is. Because the way that we speak differently to different people. We speak at a different intellectual level to different people. We use different language with different people. We're more casual with some people, more formal with other people. And so the person that you choose to speak to will determine the voice of that book. So Eat, Pray, Love, for instance, I wrote the entire thing to my friend Darcy, who is a writer also, and who was going through a divorce at the same time that I was, who was on a very similar spiritual journey to the spiritual journey that I was on. And the only difference was that she had a young child. She had a three-year-old child. So she was in no position to be able to go travel around the world by herself. But before I traveled, I had lunch with her one last time, and she gave me a hug and she said, "Take us with you. Take all of the women who would love to be doing this, all of the women who would love to be doing this, but we've chosen to be with our families, or we've got work that we can't leave, or we're not able to afford it, or we've got children. Bring us with you on this journey and remember us." And so when the time came to write the book, I really wrote it as a letter to her, like as a love letter of friendship, because I did take her with me and I wanted to take her with me into the book too.
So did you know that you were supposed to write the book from the beginning? So you had that in mind through the whole trip?
I did. My publisher had given me a book advance, so I was very aware that I had to write a book. Otherwise, they would like to have the money back. And that would be very inconvenient because I had already spent it. So I was very conscious of writing the book.
That's also maybe sometimes make it easier because you take some other things with you. But I also think that you focus on the journey that you're doing even more. It's like I love to take pictures. And one of my books, I took all the pictures inside the book and I kind of stopped and saw things in another way and actually appreciated every day because I was taking in what can I bring with me to tell the story or show the picture. Do you think that you got even more with you since you knew that you were supposed to write a book?
Yes, absolutely. Because I feel like sometimes I don't really know what happened until I write it down. So oftentimes during that journey that year, something would happen during the day because I was writing every night. So every night I had journals and I would document everything that happened during the day. And sometimes there would be something that occurred during the day or a realization that I had or an experience that I had or somebody that I met. And maybe in the moment, it was just an experience or just an interaction. But then in the evening, when I sat down and wrote about it, I would have the full understanding of what I had been taught, what the lesson was, what the magic was of that moment. And I wouldn't really feel it fully until I was sitting down to write it. That also might be because I'm a writer and writing is my art form and it's the way that I know the world. It's the way that I feel the world. But it was almost like there was a delayed reaction sometimes where, I would have the encounter. But then as I was writing the story, I would feel in my heart what had just been given to me that day. So if I didn't know that I had to write a book, I probably wouldn't have been writing as much, which means I wouldn't have been feeling as much. So the writing of the book actually gave me a deeper experience than if I had just been on a vacation.
Yeah, but I also think that it's interesting that you say that because in this podcast, I've been talking about how the brain works a lot. And if you read a text, if I read it through and then I look up and I say it out loud, then I remember it even better. So if you, during the day, sit down and reflect what happened during the day, then you will remember even more. So therefore, I think it's so important to make that reflection kind of every day when you go to bed, what happened today? Because if you think back during the day, then you will bring that day, you've been more present because you remember it in another way. So reflection is a way of helping your brain to remember.
That is so cool. I love that. It's reminding me of a spiritual practice that a meditation teacher taught me once that I've been trying to do that I think is really beautiful. And it's a deep reflection where before you go to bed each night, imagine that the day that you just had was an entire lifetime. And the theory behind this is that reincarnation is real because every morning when you wake up, it's reincarnation. So every morning, so we go to sleep, we don't know where we go when we go to sleep. We disappear into this dark space and something happens and then we have a brain reset and you wake up in the morning and it's a brand new life. And just like with deep life reincarnation, there's some things that you remember from your past life, yesterday, last year, 10 years ago. There's also some things that maybe in this lifetime, today, if each day is one lifetime, maybe this lifetime today, you're ready to evolve. And maybe there's some things that you're not going to bring with you from the past lifetime. And maybe this time, like the lessons of the past have really transformed you. So when you go to bed at night, the questions that you ask are about the day. What was the most challenging part of this lifetime? So this whole day was one life. What was the most challenging part of my life in that lifetime today? And the next question is, how did I get through that challenge? What were the tools that I used to survive the most challenging part of that life? And then the next question is, what was my favorite part of this life? And the next question is, what do I want to bring with me to the next life? And so every single day you're practicing reincarnation. And what I find really interesting is that when I reflect upon it that way, I actually realize like, oh, wow. It's exactly the same in one day. It's a microcosm as it is for my whole entire life. The most challenging part of my day is usually the thing that I find to be the most challenging part of my entire life. How I got through that challenge is usually the greatest strengths that I have for my entire life. What I loved about that day is usually what I love about my entire life. And what I want to bring into the next lifetime is what I want to keep. So it's a really beautiful way to experience each day as being. Oh, and then it's like it also prepares you to die. You know, you're practicing, like some of the great mystics say that you should spend your entire life practicing dying. So before you go to bed at night, when you practice that exercise, you're saying, I'm ready to say goodbye to this lifetime. And I'm ready to go into the next one. And if you do that every day, when the time comes to die, it might be a little easier.
Then I'm very happy to wake up the next day, though, because it's just like feeling that you're going to prepare yourself dying. It's we all know that we're going to do it one day, but it's nothing that I want to go think about every day maybe. But if you do, I just think that is something in it that my kids were young, they had two different dads. Every time I went flying, I was so afraid of something that would happen to me, so they maybe not would be living together. But then I wrote letters to them.
Aww.
That if something would happen. So I knew that they, you know, think about this when you get older. And I wrote what I wanted them to stay together every second week and stuff. And as soon as I did that, my fear of that something should happen to me disappear. So maybe that is something that you also, the fear of maybe that dying is something that you don't want to think about, maybe gets more like appreciation of what you have.
I do think so. And your understanding of the reality of the terms of life is that nobody's tomorrows are promised. Nobody is promised tomorrow. Nobody. And this is the great equalizer, because it doesn't matter what you have, what you've been given, how successful you are. There's no promise of tomorrow. And most of the time, we like to try to forget that. And most people spend their lives doing anything they can to not think about that, because it's extremely frightening. if you really, really understand that to be true. I mean, not only is my tomorrow not promised, my next 5 minutes are not promised. You know, nothing is, no future is promised. There's a terrifying element to that. But there's also, my goodness, there's nothing that could make the world feel more precious and life feel more precious. And your wisdom and understanding that it was not a guarantee that you were going to survive that airplane flight is what gave you the perspective to be able to offer your children that gift. And that's beautiful. And it's extremely precious. So yes, it was the great guru Maharishi, the Indian guru of the early 20th century, who said that the most important meditation you can do every day is to picture your death, to imagine yourself dying, to never forget that this moment is the only moment that you are promised, this one that's happening right now. And it's so precious, so important, not to hold on to in a way of desperation, but to regard as so sacred. You know, there's no such thing as an insignificant moment of life.
And that is something that with the reflection and let's kind of go into each other, the way that you're talking about looking through the day as a lifetime. So you reflect and you will remember. One thing also I was thinking about Eat, Pray, Love was that it was like the woman searching for happiness. And you did find the happiness, but how do you keep on to the happiness, and where do you actually think that the happiness, where do you find it?
Well, it's really interesting because Eat, Pray, Love has a very romantic ending, you know, and that was the true ending of that year. I met a wonderful man and I fell in love. I mean, the movie ends with us literally sailing into a sunset, right? I mean, you cannot get a more romantic imagery than that.
Den här podden gör jag tillsammans med Mindfulness-appen. Jag är så enormt stolt över det här partnerskapet. För att lära sig vara närvarande i vardagen så är det ett hjälpsamt verktyg att just ha Mindfulness-appen när man ska hantera stress och förbättra sin sömn. Och jag skulle vilja tipsa om hur jag gör för att få in vanan att meditera. Ibland kommer jag av mig, men när jag får in rutin på det så gör jag det verkligen löpande. Och det jag gör då, det är att jag mediterar samma tid och på samma plats varje dag. Börja hellre med någon minut varje dag istället för en längre stund och kom in i rutinen och öka sen därefter längden på meditationen. Det har i alla fall funkat för mig. Så jag tycker verkligen att ni ska gå in och testa Mindfulness-appen, för det finns så mycket att välja på där.
Like that's the last frame of the movie.
Atraversiamo.
Atraversiamo with Javier Bardem. I mean, what could be a better ending? and that was true. I mean, I did get to experience that beautiful love story. And that man and I stayed together for 12 really beautiful years. And then life changed, because life changes. And that constancy is not promised either. When I look back now at the Eat, Pray, Love journey, the most valuable part of the ongoing story of my happiness is not necessarily the romantic journey, but what I learned at the ashram in India. That's where the depth was, right? That's where I was given lessons that are about what do you have that cannot be taken away, right? What do you have that is not dependent upon another human being? What do you have that is not dependent upon the circumstances of your life? Where is the source of contentment that has nothing to do with what's going on outside of you? What do you have that could never be removed from you, no matter what changes? No matter what changes happen in the world, in your body, in your relationships, because that's the thing that's the most valuable. And that's what I go back to now, again and again.
One thing you said when you were in Italy and you were talking about is that the word, the woman searching for a word, what kind of word would you say that you have today to describe you?
God. I mean, that's really what all the words are. You know, I mean, that's what it all is. There's nothing that isn't that in my own personal experience and understanding. There's this, the wonderful teacher, Ram Dass, the great meditation teacher who studied with his guru in India. He said that he found his guru's diary one day. His guru had a notebook that he was always writing in. And Ram Dass was like, what does a guru write in a notebook? Like, dear diary, you know, today I'm really mad at Jennifer. You know, like, what do you, like, you know, what is an enlightened, what does an enlightened being, what is he recording? You know, like, what's in there? And so one day he stole a look at the diary, and every single page, hundreds of pages, all it said was God, 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 God. Like, he was recording his experience. And his experience was that everything that he was looking at, everything that was happening, everything was God. And that has become, it was a part of my life before. Yeah, I would say, you know, 20 years ago. I mean, the book isn't called Pray, Pray, Pray. You know, the book is called Eat, Pray, Love, right? It was, I would say that it was 33% of my existence at that time. And now I would say that it's 100% of my existence. And it's the most interesting thing to me. And it's the deepest relationship of my life. It's the most beautiful relationship of my life. It's never boring. It's wild. It's creation itself. It's you, it's me, it's the plants that I can see out of the window, it's the sky, it's the construction workers across the street, it's the shirt that I'm wearing, it's the coffee that I'm drinking, and that is source. And when I am separated from that, if I'm separated from that, nothing will make me happy. And if I'm connected to that, nothing will devastate me. That's the reality of my life.
But is it connected with you inside? I mean, because if we talk about God here, and for many people, there is someone else out there, up there somewhere. And I also know that you said something about when you get the ideas or something that you're going to write and you listen to what God says, it's like, if you feel it, just go for it. And I do understand that, but I feel more that I listen inside myself. But is that the same thing for you?
I think that we're talking about the same thing.
So the God is inside of you?
Yeah. In the yogic tradition, there are different kinds of yogis. And there are yogis who follow a path of intellectual study, who are sort of scholars, and that's how they find God, is through study. And there are yogis who do a very intense physical practice, and that's how they find God, through, you know, fasting and the movement of yoga and going into these altered consciousness spaces through physical intensity, and that's how they find God. And there's yogis who are of service, seva yogis, who are like Mother Teresa or somebody who spends their entire life serving humanity, and that's how they find God. There are so many paths to God. But there's another kind of a yogi that's called a bhakti yogi. And a bhakti yogi is a lover of God. And I love love. love is my channel. Like, love I love to love people. Love is my thing. And in order to be a bhakti yogi, and I believe that's what I am, there has to be two. There has to be duality. There has to be God, the beloved. And there has to be me, the lover of God. And there is a path of spirituality that's about non-duality, which is no separation. You know, we become one. Everything is one. And I understand that on an intellectual level, but I don't really long for that because I would miss being in love with God. And so for that, there has to be two. There has to be two. In order for love, you know, okay. for the energy of love to work, there has to be something that you love and there has to be somebody who is loving. And that's something that I enjoy. I really enjoy that feeling. So, and it's different for everybody. And I love I really am into this idea of the God of your own understanding. I think that everybody is entitled to find the God of their own understanding. But for me, I do better with an outside God. who I love with all my heart. Because that like you can see me smiling right now, but that brings me a certain joy. I don't want us to be one. I want us to be two, because otherwise there's nobody for me to love.
That's a very good explanation, though. Sometimes it's hard to, when you're talking about love yourself, it's easier that you see someone else in it, but you do connect with yourself. Yeah. Instead of like, I'm in love with me, I'm in love with what inside of me and who I am. But that's also part of then being a two of you. But I also know that you've been talking a lot about fear, and also the book, Creating a Living Beyond Fear. Fear comes up now and then. Also think it's a little bit fun, though, because my podcast is called Curious At, and you say that your curiosity is few percent more than your fear. What is fear for you? What is it that you have so much fear against?
I've always been a nervous person. Even as a child, I was a nervous, I'm a sensitive person. And I think my sensitivity as a child made me aware from a very early age that the world was a dangerous place. The world always felt like a dangerous place to me. And I'm not wrong. And I also grew up in a very intense family with some characters in my family who were not necessarily safe people. And so safety was very elusive to me as a child. I didn't know where safety was to be found, because I didn't necessarily feel safe in my house. And I didn't necessarily feel safe in the world. And I think many people experience this. I think many people experience this anxiety that comes from a feeling that the world is not safe. Now, where I've gotten to in my life now at the age of 55 is that I no longer believe that the world is supposed to be safe. I'm not sure that we come here as souls in order to experience safety. If you want safety, you came to the wrong planet. Because this planet is
that's for
wild.
Sure.
Like, this planet is absolutely wild. And being a soul incarnated in a mortal body, which is subject to pain and to sickness and to, you know, lots of disasters are available at any moment. Like, this is not a safe, it's not a safe planet. But it doesn't seem to be the rule that it's supposed to be a safe planet. I really think that we come here for adventure. I think that our souls come here to have this very strange adventure of being an eternal soul located inside of a mortal body, in an animal's body. I mean, we live inside of an animal's body. We are great apes. We live inside of a very fragile body that can experience a lot of suffering. But we have a soul that is eternal and that is beyond suffering. And that's a very interesting experience. And I feel like we come here to Earth to have a very wild adventure. And I don't know any human being who is not having a wild adventure. It doesn't matter how conservative you think your life is or how careful you try to be. Life in human form is wild. There's so much that you cannot control about what's going on in the world. And so I think fear is a very natural response to a very wild planet and a very wild experience. But what I say in Big Magic about curiosity is that curiosity is the antidote to fear. And now, speaking, I know you like to talk about the brain now, so I think you'll enjoy this, but it's actually been shown now that your curiosity is located in one hemisphere of your brain, and your fear is located in another hemisphere of your brain. Only one of them can be operating at a time. So actually, it's like a toggle switch, an on-off switch. So when your curiosity is on, your fear is off. When your fear is on, your curiosity is off. So if you feel like you're living a life where your fear is on all the time, what you actually need is more curiosity. Because when you become interested in something, somehow the fear diminishes. And I find that to be a really fascinating evolutionary process. My fear is constantly telling me not to do things. Like, just don't walk down that street. Don't travel alone. Don't write that book. don't risk having a relationship with this person. It's not safe. It's not safe. It's not safe. That's what my fear is always telling me. My curiosity is saying, well, what? I wonder what is down that road. Like, I wonder what would happen if I wrote this book. I wonder what experiences I'll have if I travel by myself. I wonder what it would feel like to have a relationship with this person. Like, my curiosity wants to know. And my curiosity, I think, is part of my eternal soul that came here to have an adventure. And I think it's willing to risk danger in order to have an interesting experience. And I think I've made that choice many times in my life, that I will risk danger in order to have an interesting experience, because I came here for adventure.
Yeah, when I think that you're so being, that talking so much about fear, that you have that and from the childhood and everything, that you're still so, so brave. And just going on that Eat, Pray, Love journey, and also when you realized that you wanted a divorce when you not just loved your friend Raya, you were in love with her, that you even though you have the fear, you're so brave taking big decisions in life to make it even better. I don't know if that's the ruin is the road to transformation thing, but sometimes you need to break it down to build it up to get it even better. But I think it's so, sometimes when you feel fear, you don't have the strength to be brave. But is it that then the curiosity comes
curiosity
in?
Curiosity is the thing. And the question that I often ask when I'm frightened is, what is the alternative? Right? So I've spent my life in creativity, which means I'm always facing my fear, because it doesn't matter how many times I write books, every time it's frightening. Every single time I'm like, this is the one that's going to be a disaster. This is the one that nobody's going to read. This is the one where I'm going to remember, find out that I actually am a bad writer. This is like, because every single time when I begin a new book, I don't know how to do it. It's incredible. I'm like, I really don't know how to do this. How do you write a book? Why do you write a book? Why am I doing this? Like, I go through all the same things that I've gone through my entire life. It never goes away. You know, and I've written 10 books now. And each time at the beginning, it's like, this doesn't even make sense. This is a totally illogical thing to do. Why am I giving myself to this experience? It's so hard. It creates so much insecurity. It's taking so much time. I could be doing other things that are a lot more fun, you know, like than sitting here on this beautiful day inside struggling. Like, why am I doing this? And the question that always arises is, well, what's the alternative? The alternative is that you don't do it. And that to me feels extremely boring. You know, like, it's just like, well, then you don't do it. And then what happens? Nothing. You know, nothing. And that's the end of the story. Right? It's like, I don't even know what to say after the word nothing. It's like, nothing. And then my life becomes nothing. And I feel like I haven't honored the experience of being here in a human form and having this adventure. So I would rather take the risk that something might be a disaster than to do nothing. Because nothing isn't what I came here for.
And it's kind of boring, though.
Yeah, right?
I think, but it's also that kind of doubt that you have instead of believing. I think that a lot of other people also feel that there's so many times that we have this doubt about, am I good enough? We have the social media. How am I supposed to be? And forget to listen into yourself and what I want to be and who am I and what can I bring to life around me instead of watching what everyone else does. And that's very easy that you feel the doubt that I'm just good enough, not good enough. And that is what I was thinking of, is that also kind of fear, not being good enough.
It's all fear. It's all fear. I mean, fear has many disguises. And perfectionism is fear. I say in the book, it's fear in a fancy fur coat and high heels and fancy jewelry, pretending to be fancy. but it's just fear. Perfectionism is deep fear. Doubt is fear. Paralysis is fear. Like laziness, what we call laziness, is often fear, right? I'm paralyzed by fear. And because I can't face my fear, I'm just going to lay on my couch and watch TV, right? That looks like laziness, but I know that that's fear. I know that that's fear of the world, fear of being hurt, fear of being seen, fear of being judged will make a person do nothing. And that looks like laziness, but it's not laziness. It's fear. It's always fear. It's always fear. It's just fear. And, you know, and I think that the thing that I have the gift of after all these years is that I can recognize fear and I can see it. I can see it in other people and I can see it because I see it in myself.
So it's a way of that. So you know that you how you're supposed to handle the fear. Is it because it's you can have the feeling of fear, but also what fear does to you. I feel more what it does to me. I don't have a problem with feeling fear because sometimes I try to be like accept it and kind of being a friend with it. It makes me focus on things I do. If I'm fear on going on stage before I do a live show on TV, I can feel a little bit of fear, but that's just a feeling. But I don't like what the fear does to me when I can't accept it. Do you see
what
the difference?
What does it do to you?
It stands in front of me, so I won't do the things that I want to do in life. It holds me back, and I don't want it to hold me back. And therefore, I try to see it as a friend and accept it instead of working against it and think, you know, what can happen? Will I survive? Yes, I will probably do that, so I don't need to be worried about it. So I need to think that way, but it's just that I think that fear also can be something that can also be my friend if I accept it and see it another way. I think that I make it more complicated sometimes than it is.
You know, I do this creativity workshop that I teach, and one of the exercises is that I have people write themselves in 5 minutes, their fear writes them a letter. They write themselves a letter from their fear. And I teach people that it's such an important exercise because your fear is allowed to exist. It's allowed to be in the room with you and it's allowed to have a voice. And I think it's deeply respectful to give it a chance to speak, you know, in a very kind way, in a compassionate way, and say, okay, I'm going to give you 5 minutes and you tell me everything that you're afraid of, and you don't argue with it. You don't write back to the letter. You don't try to soothe it. You just let it speak, right? So my letter might say like, dear Liz, I am your fear, and this is what I'm afraid of. I'm afraid you're a really selfish person. I'm afraid that you're not capable of sustaining relationships with anybody because you have had 2 divorces and you're constantly leaving relationships behind. I'm afraid that you're deeply flawed as a human being. I'm afraid that you have wasted your life. I'm afraid that you're going to die alone because you don't have children. I'm afraid that you're going to run out of money. I'm afraid that climate change is going to destroy the planet and it's going to be like Apocalypse Now and you're going to be fighting for your life on the street. I'm afraid that you're not a generous enough person, that you don't give enough to other people. I'm afraid. I mean, this is all the fears that I have, right? And so I just allow it to speak. You know, I just give it 5 minutes and it's allowed to tell me this is all the stuff that I'm afraid of. And at the end of that, I say to my fear, thank you for letting me know, you know, thank you. I think it just wants to be heard. And I had this incredible experience once where I was teaching this exercise and a woman read her letter that fear had written to her. And it was so powerful because fear said to her, you listen to me too much. It's my job to do risk assessment. It's my job as fear to look at every single situation and to give you a report on all the things that could go wrong. That's my job. It's my job in this system is to alert you that you might die, that somebody might leave you, that you might lose all your money, that you might be publicly humiliated, that you might be ashamed, that you might, the person who loves you might leave, that you might get sick, that you might get cancer, that your children might die. It's my job to tell you all of these things that might happen. It's like I'm an insurance. It's like I work for an insurance company, and my job is to assess how dangerous and risky certain situations are. But you listen to me too much. You take it too seriously, and you stop doing things just because I tell you that they're dangerous. I'm not telling you to stop. I'm just telling you what the risk is. I'm telling you what the chances are. But it's up to you to go ahead and live your life anyway. Don't give me too much power. You're giving me too much power over your life. I'm just one of the administrators who works here in this system of your mind. I shouldn't be the one who makes all the decisions. And I thought that was really cool. Like, fear was like, you're giving me too much power. I'm just here to tell you all the things that can go wrong. It doesn't mean don't do it. You know, sometimes it's worth it to take the risk. Sometimes you should jump out of an airplane because, yeah, you might die, but it's worth the risk because it's an amazing experience. Go for it. Sometimes you should get married. You know, yeah, you could get divorced, but you should try it anyway. Take the risk. Don't be so afraid. Don't be so driven by me. Don't give me all the power in the room. I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, it's just a very nice way also to talk to the fear as it is sure. A person. To guide you through, because then it doesn't be that kind of, then it's easier to control it, I think, that you have someone, you can talk to it, and it's actually talking to yourself in a way. So it makes it easy in that way, but also that you're kind of holding on to things. And that is another part in Eat, Pray, Love that meant so much to me, even though it could be fear, but it could be so many other things that it's kind of chaotic out in life. And my life is not that if I'm not holding on to it. If I'm holding on to a bad relationship, my life will be chaotic. But if I let it go, then it will be hard for a while, but then it will be easier when I let go. And that is one thing that was really strong for me to realize, and it made it easier. The words that you make the sentences so easy, so I really did see it. But also sometimes it's really hard sometimes to let go. And I know that you're also now writing, I don't know if you finished it because I couldn't figure it out, the book about addiction.
I've finished a first draft, but it won't be published for probably another year.
Oh, you finished the first draft. But that is also one thing I was thinking of, but addiction may be something else because you don't really know when you're in addiction, but it's something that you hold on to that makes your life complicated or chaotic. It's hard to let it go.
People, places, and things.
So sometimes it is.
That's what we hold on to, right? Yeah. We hold on to people. We hold on to places. We hold on to things. And that's when life becomes chaotic. Yeah.
When you realize it and were supposed to let go of it, when you realize that that was the chaotic thing, how long time did it take you to actually start the process of letting go? I mean, sometimes it feels like that. You just let go of those things and then it's easy and then it sounds more easy. It's a process, of course. So how was that process for you?
So for me, I can't let go. If I'm in addiction, the proof has already been shown that I don't have the power to let go. This thing is now controlling me. I am now being controlled by this addiction. So I need a higher power than myself. I can't cure my addictions myself. I can't. If I could, it wouldn't be an addiction. You know, it would just be a thing that I don't do anymore. You know what I mean? Like, but the fact that I can't stop doing it, there's three really good questions to ask about that help you see if you're in addiction. And this can be, again, about people, places, and things. Have you tried to stop and you can't? That's the first question. Have you stopped, but you can't stay stopped? So, you know, you put the thing down, but then you, for a while, but then you come back to it again. Often this is true of very dysfunctional relationships. Like you separate from the person for a little while, but you can't stay away. Something in you makes you go back. You go back into that chaos again. You go back You go back for more abuse. You go back for more pain. You go back for more cigarettes. You go back for more sugar. You go back for more alcohol. You go back. So, you know, lots of times an addict will say, I can stop anytime, which is true. You can. But how long can you stay stopped? You know, yeah. Like, you can stop for a week. Anybody can stop for
Important
a week,
question.
Right? It's like, can you stay stopped? And the third question is, have there been consequences to your life because of this thing or this person or this behavior? Have there been consequences to your life that if a normal person had that consequence, the normal person would say, oh, wow, now that I see the consequence of this, I'm certainly never going to do that again, but you keep doing it again, right? There's been consequences that are very costly to you, but you keep doing it. That's an addiction. And the proof is that you can't stop. So for me, the only cure for addiction is a spiritual cure. I need a higher power than myself to help me. And I need to give my life to God. That's the only way that I could stop. I have to stop. Because if I just stop, then I still have all the problems that caused me to do that thing in the first place. Right? I still have all the pain that caused me to do that thing in the first place. So I have to stop and I have to give my life to something bigger than me. And I have to say, I'm giving my life to you, God. You take it. I have a friend who's an addict in recovery and she has a tattoo on her arm with an arrow that points up and it says, here, you take it. Like, and she means her whole life. It's like, here, you take it. And you guide me. You tell me what you want me to do. Because I obviously am not capable of making good decisions for myself.
Yeah, but I think sometimes you feel like that you have such a big responsibility yourself to think in a special way, or you talk to, you write the letters about fear and stuff, but it's you can also ask for help. And I think that is a very important thing to know. That it's not, even though you work with yourself and it's a lot of things up to you, it's important to know that part of it is also that you realize it, but I need help. And there's so many other people that wants to help.
Help
you.
Is available.
It's kind of a gift to help someone.
Help is available from is available from within yourself. That part of you that you were talking about earlier about like looking within. Help is available from within. Help is also available from without. Help is available from other human beings, and help is available from the beyond. Help is available from the universe. Help is available in all directions. They didn't send you here to Earth to do this alone. You're not supposed to do it alone. There are certain things that you have to go away for small periods of time and be alone in order to be able to hear. Like, I've had to spend a lot of my life in solitude and silence in order to be able to hear the help that was available to me from God, because I couldn't hear that voice if I was around too many people. But I wasn't alone. I was with another presence. I was with divinity. I was with guides. I was with intuition. But I needed to be in silence to be able to hear it. But I have also needed help from people, and I've gotten help from people. I'm not ashamed to ask for help. I will always ask for help. Always.
I'm so happy that I got the chance to talk to you. We're going to send this on Sunday. So that's just almost a week before you come to Stockholm with your tour. What can we expect? What are we going to, what are we looking forward to?
That is so sweet. Well, I am going to talk about love. I'm going to talk about creativity. I'm going to talk about divinity. I'm going to bring an hour-long talk that is a distillation of the best of what I have learned in 55 years of my life. I'm going to bring you my whole entire heart. And I can promise you that that is what I will bring you, because that's what I want to bring you. And then we will also have time after the talk for questions from the audience, which is my favorite part of the night. So bring your questions. And if there's anything that you want to ask me, I will certainly do my absolute best to answer your questions with, again, my whole entire heart. So I'll be telling stories from my life and lessons from my life. And then I'll be talking to you personally during the conversation part of the evening. So it will be very intimate, very sincere, very honest. And most of all, it will be about love.
We're looking forward so much to see you. I bought the VIP ticket because I want to sit in front.
So I'm going to meet you in person.
Yes, because it said on the voucher that I you also will have a picture. So then I will thank you in person for this hour. And I'm so happy that you're in London. So you're 1 hour before me. So it's kind of early in the morning after your first show here in Europe. I will say to everyone listening, you have your website, elizabethgilbert.com. And also on there, they can click on events so they can find where your European tour. You go to Germany after you've been in Stockholm. So you will find your tour plan there. And also Instagram, Elizabeth Gilbert Writer, you can search for and then you find you there. A lot of inspiration you send to us through all your different kinds of platforms and all the books. And this is, I've been laughing a lot when I read this book.
Aww.
And I just want to have the last thing that I think it was so much when I read about your neighbor that's she created her body with tattoos. And can we take that as an ending? Because I think it's kind of so people can bring with them what they will create in their life. The story.
Yes. Oh, I love that you brought that up. And I also just wanted to say, Kristen, thank you for giving me an hour of your time and sharing me with the people who listen to you. And thank you for continually having the courage to put yourself out there in the world and to put your ideas out there in the world and to podcast and to write books and to go on TV. And every single woman who allows herself to be seen gives permission to other women to allow themselves to be seen. So just thank you. And I can't wait to meet you in person. And I have a present for you. So I'll give you a little gift when I see you. but thank you so much. And to close with the story. So I have a neighbor who not only has a lot of tattoos, but she gets tattoos very casually, which I find incredible because it seems like it's such a big commitment to get a tattoo. And sometimes if she's having a bad day, she'll wake up in the morning and she'll say, I'm going to go get a tattoo. And I said to her, what are you getting? And she said, I don't know. I'll decide when I get there. And I'm like, oh my God, you're making this decision. And I said, do you ever feel stressful about that? Because it's such a permanent thing. Like you're getting this permanent thing on your body. And she said, no, Liz, it's temporary. Tattoos are temporary. And I said, oh, I don't understand. Are you getting temporary tattoos? And she said, oh, no, it's real ink. It's a real tattoo. But my body is temporary. That's the thing. It's all temporary. My body is temporary. And I just decided that because it's temporary and it's only going to be here for a while, I'm going to decorate it however I want. And I found that to be such a beautiful and inspiring story. And your life is temporary in this form. Your soul is eternal, but your life and your body are temporary. And you, my dears, whoever is listening, you have the right to decorate your life however you want, to make yourself into the work of art however you want, because you're only going to be here for a little while. And that's the beautiful thing. So the stakes are actually low. And thank you so much for your time.
Yeah, thank you so much. See you next week.
Thank you again. I really appreciate it.
See you next week. Bye-bye.
Och jag vill passa på att avsluta med att säga stort tack till Mindfulness-appen för att de vill göra den här podden med mig.